Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Johnny Giles is a national treasure. When he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love Johnny Giles.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Phil Egan, good morning.
Morning, how are you doing?
Very well. We've got your Monday headlines right here, and I'm going to read them out. We've got three headlines today. So on Monday's newspapers, it says here, Fox sake. So I think you're predicting a Liverpool or Leicester City defeat on Sunday. Is that what we're saying here?
Well, it works both ways. I've covered myself there, because if Leicester win, then yeah, that can be elation. That can be Leicester's celebration. But if obviously that can apply to Manchester United as well, as in for, as the headline says, if they lose and they don't get that top four spot.
It's kind of remarkable that we found ourselves in this situation on the final day, isn't it? Like, it's very, very rare. Like, we have dramatic Champions League situations down through the year. Like, I mean, food poisoned gate with Spurs back in 2006 when Arsenal swooped on in and got the top four position. But actually where these two teams are going head to head on the final day, I can't remember a time like this.
Yeah, because the last few times we've had situations where under Klopp, Liverpool have had to win on the final day. I know they had to beat Brighton, they had to beat Middlesbrough, but they were games they were expected to win. Whereas, like, the only surprise over the last few weeks is how Wolves dropped a few points, where it wasn't all going to be one bumper day, where two places, two games, where it was all going to be on the Chelsea Wolves and Leicester Man United game. So now, obviously, you know, you could get a situation where, you know, United lose, but they still finish in the top four. Whereas, you know, maybe last week or a couple of weeks ago, it looked like it could be a winner takes all. But you'd still favour United, because even though the last couple of performances haven't been great, I'm not going to give them a free pass for the cup final or semi-final, but they change things. They obviously, Solskjaer showed that his priority is getting that top four finish. They are third. When you think back to earlier this year, at one stage, Leicester were 14 points ahead of Manchester United. United have reeled them in. They've done all the hard work. Now they just have to finish it off. But I think it'll actually suit United. They obviously won't play for the draw, but they can sit in and let Leicester have possession. And Leicester, you know, they're not as creative as they have been, because they're obviously missing James Maddison. They're missing their two fullbacks as well. And United, if they can pick them off in the break, I think they'll... It should be a comfortable enough afternoon for them.
There's been plenty of questions about what Manchester United need to do in the transfer market in order to solidify that defence a little bit more. It's been a leaky defence. We've seen it getting caught quite a bit on set pieces. There's been a lot of criticism of Victor Lindelof, and that's fair enough. They will need to strengthen at the back if they want to challenge for the Premier League. But where did their attack rate, in your opinion, Phil, if you're comparing them to Liverpool, to Manchester City, to Chelsea's next season attack? Like, are they a top three attack whatsoever? I know we put this to Andy Mitten yesterday, but it just seems that all the criticism and all the suggestions of how Manchester United are to improve is focused on the defence, where they probably need to make a couple of attacking signings as well.
Yeah, big time. I mean, they're obviously linked with Jadon Sancho, and I think people have said the form of Mason Greenwood means that Jadon Sancho isn't as much of a priority. But if Jadon Sancho is available, United have to go after him, and they have to strengthen, because Greenwood's been sensational in the last few months, but you need strength and depth. Also, you look at the other night, Rashford wasn't very good. You know, you have to get that consistency. It's very easy to say over the last couple of months since the restart that United's front three has been excellent, but you have to do it over a full season at least. You have to start getting consistency, producing over a couple of seasons. The potential is there anyway. I think out of the three, Greenwood, we've heard a lot about him in recent years, how this guy was destined for getting to the top. It's actually Anthony Martial who surprised me the most, because I've always been a fan of Rashford. I think in an attacking team, Rashford, that's where you get the best of him. But Martial, at times, you know, nothing even to do with the price tag that they paid Monaco, because, you know, he didn't set that. But he's shown glimpses. But actually, in the last few weeks, he's shown a bit of, you know, he's got a bit of bite about him as well. And sometimes he drifts in and out of games, but he's been excellent. Now, can they do that at the start of next season? And, you know, when there's a clean slate at the start of next season, and if United make a few signings, the pressure will be on. It won't be, you know, let's get into the top four. Now people are saying, OK, you're in the top four, and not only do you stay there, you have to start closing the gap on the likes of Liverpool and Manchester City. So that comes, with that comes an added pressure. So can that front three answer that? We don't know. We won't know until next season. But I certainly think they need backup there. I mean, look at the bench now. Who, if they are bringing on players, the likes of Juan Mata, Jesse Lingard, they're not up to it. You mentioned Victor Lindelof. Yeah, they need another player. Is Harry Maguire really going to win a Premier League title for you? Luke Shaw has had obviously he's injured at the moment. He's had an okay, he's solid, but is he going to take it to that next level? Wan-Bissaka is obviously an excellent defender, and something that he needs to improve on, obviously, is his attacking. But first and foremost, he is a defender. So, you know, that's something that he can work on, his attacking side of things. And the goalkeeper's an issue as well. So it's like there's plenty of work to do, but... Do you know what? If they can get into the top four, then they build on that.
The story this week was that Chelsea might be coming in for Dean Henderson. What do you do in this situation if you're Manchester United and you have a club coming in for Henderson who'll pay him up to 130 grand a week, I think was the figure that's been mentioned in the British press this week. How do Manchester United guarantee that he will be happy at the club if they want to keep David De Gea? I personally can't see a workable situation here. They'll have to probably give the guy a guarantee that he can come in and actually get some game time. Basically, this is a roundabout way of asking, what's your view on the De Gea situation and how he managed to fix this?
De Gea obviously isn't what he used to be. Dean Henderson, like, there's been a lot of calls for Dean Henderson to come in because he's been so good for Sheffield United, but there's a big difference with being a goalkeeper for Sheffield United and Manchester United. If he was to come in and replace David De Gea, if Solskjaer said, right, you're now our number one, he's only 23. That's a lot of pressure. And, you know, you can have the odd off day for Sheffield United. Look what happens when De Gea has an off day for Manchester United. He is all over the headlines. He obviously was at fault for a couple of goals against Chelsea on Sunday. And what did Solskjaer have to do in the press conference before the West Ham game? He had to shut it down by saying, this is not going to be a David De Gea press conference. So that's the kind of scrutiny you're under if you're the Manchester United goalkeeper. Dean Henderson is good. We don't know. It goes back to what I said about the front three. You don't really know until you're thrown in there if you're good enough. And from what we've seen of Dean Henderson, he certainly has the potential, but that's all it is at the moment. As I said, it is a huge, huge ask for a young goalkeeper to be the number one at Manchester United to obviously, like, you know, if it happened, say, for example, that Dean Henderson was sitting on the bench next season and De Gea got injured, then Dean Henderson takes over, that's fine. But actually, if you were basically saying to him, you know, there's the keys to the house, it's all yours, that's a serious bit of pressure.
We obviously should just get Quevin Kelleher in, Phil, like, let him off to go to step down the grades a little bit at a lesser club, give him some experience. You know, send him out on loan and bring him back to a big club. Come here, joking aside, like the 3-6 battle is obviously fascinating. Who's done better this year, Brendan Rodgers or Nuno Espirito?
Do you know what? The way Wolves are finishing the season, I know they've dropped a few points, obviously the Arsenal game and the Sheffield United game, but Wolves are still in Europe. And the unfortunate thing for Leicester is the wind has come out of the sails. But if they finish the job off on Sunday, if they finish top four, then my answer would be Brendan Rodgers. Because at the start of the season, we were talking about the top six. Can anyone break into it? Wolves were definitely mentioned. There was a concern about Wolves because of the Europa League and they started their season so early. But actually, the way they play on the counter-attack, you know, they conserve energy better than most clubs would. With Leicester, there was talk they could break into the top six. There was that potential at the end of last season. There was a glimpse of what we could see. Don't forget, like at Christmas time, people were talking about Leicester being Manchester or Liverpool's nearest rivals because it was clear Manchester City all was not right there. And obviously Leicester lost those games to Liverpool and City in the space of a couple of days. But, you know, what's been shown over the last few weeks is they don't have the strength and depth in the in their squad. But as I said, if Rodgers gets that top four spot, then yeah, I'd be saying he's had a better season.
The next headline this morning, Phil, is with regards to Liverpool. 99 Reds ballooned is how the Monday morning headline reads. What's this about?
Okay, well, obviously Liverpool are on 96 points at the moment, which is a significant number in Liverpool's history. You know, the number that you'll often see justice for 96 when Liverpool relate to the Hillsborough disaster. So they're on 96 points now. Obviously, if they beat Newcastle on the final day, they go to 99 points. Now, why I've gone for Reds ballooned, obviously we know the song, but I'd say they're probably still celebrating. Jurgen Klopp the other night looked like a man that, you know, he was going to be making the phone call to say, yeah, I don't know if I'll be home this evening. You know, you know, when you see me, you'll see me. We saw obviously what happened when Liverpool played Manchester City. There was a few indications that a few players had done more damage to themselves than others. There's obviously quite a few players in the Liverpool squad that don't actually drink. Two of the front three, we know James Milner doesn't either. Probably there are a few more in there as well. But yeah, I'd say they've enjoyed their last few days, but they'll probably enjoy going to Newcastle. It's a fixture that tends to be quite kind to Liverpool. They've had some good wins there. Obviously, they needed a late goal last season to get a 3-2 win. But yeah, if they don't actually win, I think Liverpool fans would think there'd be something quite fitting about winning the Premier League title on 96 points.
Yeah, it's a good point. I hadn't realised it till after the game the other night, actually. It'd be remarkable if that was how they actually finished. It's going to be ballot day tomorrow, I think, in the Football Awards. Look, we've had this conversation multiple times before. And are you a Kevin De Bruyne?
No.
Oh, sorry. Which side of the defence have you fallen on here?
Well, I think if I'm going for Young Player of the Year for me would be Trent Alexander-Arnold. And then for Player of the Year, it's Van Dijk or Mane for me. Van Dijk has played every league game for the last two seasons. Take him out of the Liverpool team, they're not what they are at the moment. He makes the game look so easy. He doesn't break a sweat. He made a mistake last week against Arsenal and, you know, it was almost reassuring to see that he is human. So I think the only thing that might count against him is the fact that he won it last season, that, you know, people would think, well, this is what he does anyway, so is it really a surprise? Sometimes somebody could win it because they go to a level that we didn't think they had, and that's maybe where the Jordan Henderson stuff is coming from.
Final headline from Monday, looking into the future here. What were you thinking? What without the H? So this is about Watford FC, I dare say, Phil. Yeah.
Watford relegated from the Premier League. Three managers this season, sorry. Well, Hayden Mullins, I suppose, would count as the fourth.
Yeah.
But yeah, to get rid of Nigel Pearson, look, they wouldn't have beaten Manchester City the other night with Nigel Pearson there, but it's just the way they chop and change. And, you know, for a couple of seasons, people have said it's, you know, doesn't seem like the best way to manage things, but they've stayed in the Premier League comfortably most seasons. But this is the season they've come unstuck. And the signs were there towards the end of last season where they went on a bad run, but Javi Garcia had a bit of time on his hands because they obviously got to the cup final, so he was all right there. But obviously his time ran out early enough this season. Not many teams would have any beef with Watford, but Arsenal do.
Mm.
Troy Deeney
good
has
point.
You know, he's talked smack about Arsenal a lot, like, you know,
where are your cojones?
Where are your cojones? Remember, then he had a penalty himself at the Emirates and he missed it. He didn't have the cojones. So this would be a chance now for Arsenal to bury Watford and just say, we'll show you where our cojones are. Now, Arsenal obviously didn't have a shot on target against Villa the other night, but it's at the Emirates. I think Arsenal will be a lot better. And you kind of think Watford are going to have to win this game because a draw won't be good enough if Villa get a draw away to West Ham.
This is good for football, the current situation in the relegation battle, right? We want Aston Villa to survive, and who cares about Watford and Bournemouth?
Well, I mean, there's obviously Watford and Bournemouth fans listening and they're screaming at you now.
I know, but like as
there's a lot of Villa fans.
As neutrals, you know.
Yeah, we've obviously...
I think Arsenal will be doing a favour for everybody if they relegate Watford.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. And then obviously if they stay up, what happens to Jack Grealish? It seems like he's going to go anyway, regardless of... But if they get relegated, it makes Jack Grealish's decision for him, where, you know, he's a Villa supporter. If they get relegated, he can just say, well, I need to move on. I think Villa fans wouldn't hold it against him if he left, if he was part of the team that stayed up. And then it's up to Villa then to be able to recruit and be able to sustain Premier League football for the next few years without Jack Grealish.
So call it, Phil. Who's finishing 3rd, 4th, 5th and 17th?
OK, so I think it'll be United and Chelsea will finish in United 3rd, Chelsea 4th, and in the last relegation spot, obviously we know Norwich are gone. I think Bournemouth will go and I think Watford will go as well.
So status quo at the bottom of the table. Thanks a million, Phil.
Cheers, guys.
OTB AM.
With Gillette, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
Right, it is the final day of the Premier League on Sunday and loads of great storylines to get stuck into. Delighted to say that David Myler is with us. David, how are you getting on?
Good morning, Owen. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Let's look back on Wednesday night. First of all, Jordan Henderson lifting the Premier League trophy. Not a bad feeling, I'd say, to see your buddy lift it, do the Hendo shuffle and send Liverpool into ecstasy.
Yeah, like everybody who's like a Liverpool supporter would have been wondering, was he okay? Obviously, he picked up the injury and then I'd spoken to him 3 or 4 days out and he said, no, I think I should be okay to do it. And then I asked, are you going full JT with the kit? And he said, I'm not putting my shin pads on, but I'm putting the full lot on. And I said, you have to really, because for such an iconic moment, I said, you don't want to be standing there in your tracksuit lifting the trophy and that. So I said, like, as much as people like to take the mick out of John Terry, I think everybody in the same situation would have done the exact same. So, no, look, watching him lift it, tremendously proud of him, so happy for him. It's a huge honour. Like the 12 months he's had winning, you know, the Champions League, Super Cup, the World Club Cup, and then the Premier League, and to captain them and lift all the trophies is just phenomenal stuff, really.
What is the foundation of the resilience that exists in Jordan Henderson's mind to go from a place where that Liverpool team was roundly derided, I think, by a lot of people at the end of the Brendan Rodgers tenure, or at least during a period in that time? Like, you're just looking back on the Stoke 6-1 game 5 years ago, last month or the month before, and he's one of the only players still there, I think the only starter who's still involved with the squad from that day. Why is it Jordan Henderson that is the man that made that step up and is the man who's managed to hang around to get to this level?
Well, if I go back a long time ago when we played together at Sunderland, Dwight York was there. And obviously Dwight York is famous for playing for Manchester United, being involved in the treble winning season in 99, a phenomenal player. But he used to always say, it's easy to get to the top, the hardest thing is staying there. And I think that's, like, when you speak about Jordan, I think it's testament to his mentality. I know a lot of he has a lot of doubters. A lot of people think he's not great. Look, he's a superb footballer. Is he on the level of a Kevin De Bruyne? No. But is there anyone else in the world on that level who plays midfield? Probably not, no. But when you look at Jordan, it's a testament to his character, the type of person he is, the way he pushes himself. You know, you speak about the time with Brendan Rodgers, like when it looked like he was going to go to Fulham, but he, said, no, I'm not going. Knuckles down, puts his head down, keeps working hard and just does the basics right and sticks the course. And then he reaps his rewards. You know, you look at two years previous to when Brendan made him captain, he was nearly gone and then he makes him captain. And then to go on, I think Jurgen Klopp has evolved him into an even better player and a better person. I think a lot of it stems from the manager now. But it's just, it's remarkable that, for anyone that's young, trying to, carve out a career in the game, he's a fella that you should look at, that, hard work and desire gets you a lot of the way.
Do you think that evolution will continue, David, like that? You talk about sort of him as a person, and we've all seen the evidence of that over the last few months, and the evolution of him. Like, he tends to get, you've hinted at it there, but that backhanded compliment of, he got the most out of his career kind of a thing, which is sort of serves a double purpose of saying that he's not great. He's turned 30 recently, and I just wonder about that evolution under Klopp. Like, how much longer can he be a force in that Liverpool midfield?
I think time catches up with all of us, but I still feel he has another 2-3 seasons left in him at that level. I certainly do. Now, you look at a Ryan Giggs who evolved his game, then you look at players like even, say, someone like Steven Gerrard, who's at Liverpool previously, he evolved his game. I certainly think the way he conducts himself off the pitch, the lifestyle he lives, he does give himself the best chance. He doesn't drink, doesn't go out. Like, he eats healthy, even from when I first met him at 18, that's 12 years ago. He looks after himself even more now than he did then. So I'd certainly think, you know, he's many seasons left at Liverpool as captain.
Was he nervous when you were talking? Because there was a good shots of him before during the game, obviously sat in the stands and like a kind of a nervous smile, and he was obviously getting a bit of ribbon from some of the lads around him about what he was going to do for the trophy lift and that. Was he nervous about it, excited about it?
No, I think look, you're excited about it. I imagine he had butterflies that, you know, everybody who's young that plays football wants to win the Premier League. And then you go and you captain your team to win in the Premier League. I think, you know, the excitement takes over. It's kind of like they want, obviously they're playing Chelsea at the time, a very good team in good form, coming off a huge result against United in the FA Cup, that he was probably desperate for the team to win to kind of keep that high buzz around, you know, the ground. Imagine if they had lost and then were presented the trophy, it wouldn't have been great. No, but it's full of excitement. You're getting to do something that, I think he's one of now 13 people who've lifted the Premier League title. So, you know, he's put his name in the history books in Premier League. And then, of course, being the first Liverpool captain to do it. So the excitement would have been the whole way through. I don't think he'd have been nervous.
Is not drinking becoming a necessary step if you want to achieve big things in top-tier football, David? I mean, times have obviously changed. There's less people. Like, I mean, people don't do it to the level they used to in terms of professional footballers. But it seems that the way recovery has been limited now with so many competitions, the summers are getting more and more packed with summer tours, that actually a little bit of downtime to go drinking for a while, it's just not possible as a modern footballer.
Well, I think if you look back to the early 90s when the Premier League first started, you'd have had a lot of British and Irish players playing. I think the Premier League has evolved. Mm. It's now global. You look at the different cultures. We have a lot of, like, say, Muslim players who do not drink at all. If you look back to Arsene Wenger's time when he brought in the French lads, like, I think Arsene Wenger was probably the first to kind of change it with nutritionists, like keeping track of what players, you know, were eating, etc., etc. I think it has evolved over time, but the good old Irish in me would say there's nothing wrong with, you know, a few drinks on a Saturday night after you win a game. Of course, the times of going out till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and drinking heavily have gone. You know, you can't afford to do it if you're playing Saturday, Tuesday. And the level that certainly Jordan and Liverpool are at, you know, the games are all so big that you're expected to win and you're expected to put in a performance that you can't give people an excuse to nail you about. That's the way I'd probably look at it. But I don't see nothing wrong with, you know, a drink here and there after to celebrate kind of a good result or a good performance. It's just obviously no one went to stop or, you know, like that really.
One of the interesting offshoots of having no fans in the ground, as weird as it makes, maybe the celebrations afterwards, you get to hear a lot of stuff that goes on the pitch and on the sideline. And I'm sure you may have seen the clip of Frank Lampard and Jurgen Klopp going at it for a couple of minutes on the sideline at some point or another. And part of me was thinking, like, you know, fair play to Frank Lampard, and this is like lesson number one in the Jose Mourinho school of coaching, that, you know, you give it a little bit on the sideline and sort of make your opposite number know you're there. But there was definitely a part of me that was thinking that maybe actually Frank Lampard, and he's still young in his managerial career, lost the run of himself a little bit, that he was sort of out of control a bit and was allowing himself to get brought into a situation that wasn't keeping his mind on the game, or, you know, a great message to necessarily send out to his players. What did you make of it all on the Lampard side?
I don't mind it. If you remember, BT Sport released a clip of, I think it was Mason Greenwood's second against Bournemouth, and I think it was Adam Smith had said something to Ramsdale in the goal, and then Ramsdale came out and he was effing and blinding. This, it's part and parcel of the game. I think, like, you know, you touch on Lampard and Klopp. I think Frank was obviously kicking off about a foul that wasn't given and what have you. It is part and parcel of the game. You can talk about fellas aren't, you know, they're probably taking their eye off the ball for a minute or two, but it's such a demanding job, and there's so much at stake that, you know, he's showing that he cares and he's passionate. Yeah, you kind of, like, he felt the Liverpool bench were being over the top. And then, of course, you know, after one of the goals, all the staff run out, which is a bit much, like, you know, but it does happen. I do think now that there's no fans there and the noise is, I quite like it, being able to hear, because look, the amount of sledging that went on, you know, on the pitch was remarkable, you know, when I played. You look at even in rugby games, it's probably the exact same. It's everywhere, you know, it's just, I don't think people expect it to be at the level it's at. I always say you can't understand the football banter unless you actually, you know, you share a change room with a group of players, that it is cutthroat, it is ruthless. So I've no problem with it. You know, managers give and go. Like,
you don't mind them getting involved with other managers and with players, David? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I have. Well, I should have known that was an open-end question. Even so, if you look back on my incident, there was a few things said in between that was never picked up. He made reference to me, I made reference to him. And then, you know, that's just the way it, I think that's the way it is. You kind of, it's you want to show no weakness. You want to show no, like, that I don't care about you. Do you know what I mean? I had something years ago. I played against Man City. I think I cleaned Gareth Barry out in a tackle, and he got up, and I told him where to go. And then I was thinking of all, like, this fella's played over, I don't know what it is, 500-600 times in the Premier League. I thought he could literally say anything to me. Like, he's won the Premier League, he's won FA Cups, he's played for England in a couple of major tournaments. What he said to me was, "You're ugly." And I was looking, I'm kind of going, of all the things you could have said to me, that's what you've said to me. And I said, I'm not really bothered about that. So that's just your opinion. Well, I was like, you could have hit me a bit harder, like, but yeah. It happens all the time, fellas. Do you know what I mean? Whenever there's a bad tackle, somebody will say something to someone. You know, it's just...
Was Pardew's few words a bit worse than that, or...?
Oh, yeah. I've definitely... Obviously, we're early in the morning here, so I can't really say too much, but... Yeah, look, No. But look, it's part and parcel of it. It happens in a GA pitch. You imagine, you know, someone who's as passionate as Davy Fitz. You don't think he's holding his tongue, like, and I imagine he's effing and blind and have a cut off, you know, players or
John Milan.
Yeah, John Milan, another one. Yeah, prime example. But that's the beauty of him, isn't it? Mm. I imagine, like, you would, if you, you know, look at the Gooch probably said nothing to no one ever. But I imagine a lot of fellas who are marking him probably tried to have a cut off him and try to get in his head, but it clearly didn't work.
I watched some of that again this morning. Steve Bruce was out afterwards, and he was saying about he was glad it was you that was involved, because you weren't going to be rolling around, and you were. He said you were restrained enough to not punch him back. It looked at the time as if that might have been a fine enough line. You were eager to get at him.
I was, yeah. Obviously, when it all happens, then your emotions kick in, and you know. If you look back at the video, like, I do cock my right hand, and it's Ahmed El Mohammadi kind of just knocks me off balance. No, I'm not going to say, you know, I would hit him or whatever, but I'd have probably tried to grip hold of him. I think it's testament to my GA background, you know, of playing all the way up to minor before I moved to England, that, like, I was like, I can't be dropped to the floor here by an old fella, like. I said, it won't go down. And I said, my dad's in the crowd as well. I said, like, you know, the things that run through my head at the time were, as if I go off the pitch here and I go to meet my dad after, and the first thing he'd say, regardless, I know we got beaten 4-1 or whatever, but he'd have just gone, "You're gone soft, you boy. I can't believe this dropped you." You know, it would have been. But even if you look at after then, Pardew goes away, and, you know, Alan Pardew's assistant at the time was John Carver. He came all chirpy, and, like, I remember I turned to him and I said, "I'll finish you in the tunnel, you little midget." That's what I said to him. probably can't repeat what I said to Pardew at the time, but yeah. Hey, look, it's part and parcel of it. Emotions run high, like, and I'm currently in the process of doing my A license, and the other day we had a fantastic presentation by Paul Ozan, who's a tutor, and obviously he's the Ireland under 16 manager, and it was his presentation was on sideline behaviour. And then you look back at different moments and different things, It was really interesting. Like, and do you know, obviously, as I evolve in my road to management, I'll have to check a few things I do, and I'm learning a lot from it.
Can I just add, I watched the his apology afterwards, in inverted commas, felt like the greatest non-apology of all time.
It wasn't an apology, and he never. I covered Hull v Chelsea in the FA Cup last season, and obviously Jay Humphrey asked me about it and whatever, and I said, Alan Pardew never apologised. Now, I've told the story a few times. I might have even told the lads on Off the Ball, but I had a phone call the following morning, and it was, hello, David, this is Chief Inspector such and such from Hull Police Station. And I said, yeah, good one. Like, I thought it was one of the lads ringing me up for a wind-up, and I hung up, and then the phone rang again, same thing. It was only the club secretary of Hull that rang me and said, no, Dave, this is the police. Do you want to press charges? And I was like, no. I said, look, it's nothing. Like, do you know what I mean? But I could have proceeded, you know, to obviously press charges and go after him. But no, I wouldn't say it was a headbutt, like, but, you know, he could have had the decency to acknowledge that, like, I didn't roll around, you know, the floor crying. I didn't make a big scene of it. I left it go. He did. His secretary wrote a letter that he signed, but that was like the interview he did, which is a token. It was nothing, like, do you know what I mean?
He said he was. I was trying to push him away with my head, is what he was saying afterwards.
Yeah.
Which.
Yeah. I'm sure. Look. Each their own. I've moved on from it. Do you know what I mean? I don't really. Like, it's 6 years ago. You know what I mean? People still talk about it, still bring it up. Even if you watch Match of the Day there, they did, you know, during lockdown, they did one of them top 10 bizarre moments, and I think I was voting at number two.
The thing is, it just was so mad. And, like, when you look at the record of Alan Pardew, we'll move on from it now, but, like, he's got this record of... We were sort of half joking about it earlier on, that, like, the list of people that he said Barney's with in the sideline are, like, this list of old men, like Pellegrini and Wenger, Martin O'Neill, and you. but it was just so wild. But
did he have an argument with Martin?
Yes, he did. Yeah.
I'm not surprised Martin didn't ring me and say put him in the ground.
It's interesting when Lampard talks about giving it all that, giving it the big un. Like, I think the biggest of the big uns was Alan Pardew dancing in the FA Cup final when they took the lead against Manchester United and then ended up getting beaten. Like, is that something that really winds you up as a player when you see the opposition giving it the big un? Is that a thing? Is like Lampard's anger and his fury midweek, is that commonplace in football?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Like, you touched on the dance, like... I remember when Punchin scored, and, like, you're thinking, steady yourself, because you're playing Manchester United. You know, they've got some exceptional players on the pitch, like, that, you know, I don't know. I think Punchin scored after about 25, 30 minutes. Like, it wasn't as if he'd scored in the last minute that, like, you've more or less won it. Like, you're just asking for it to come back and bite you in the arse. Like, but I think. Like, you know, obviously Frank has a pop off Jürgen, and obviously I saw Nathan talking to Mark Lawrenson this morning, and he does have a touch of arrogancy, but I suppose you look at all the greats, Sir Alex, you know, Jose Mourinho, Pep Guardiola, Jürgen Klopp, they all have that touch of arrogance, and I think you do need that. Like, Frank will certainly have a touch of it from his playing career that he's going to take into managing. I think that's the edge he has. I've played under managers that are super nice, and sometimes it doesn't really work. You need to have that bit, something bit different. I think when you talk about giving it the big in, certain lads react differently to it. I'd strive to kind of beat you then, or, like, you know, take on the challenge. Other lads might kind of go, yeah, I'm out of my league here. I can't deal with someone like him. I loved it. Like, if somebody gave it the big in, I'd be like, yeah, I've marked your card now. I'm coming after you.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, like, nobody should get too precious about it. Like, I think there's a necessary arrogance that's required. And, like, at the time, I think it's kind of surprising to everybody to hear what Frank Lampard is saying. But it's only surprising because we don't ever get to hear this. Managers aren't mic'd up, and we don't get to hear it when there's a full stadium. So that's why this is an outlier, I feel. That I think this is more commonplace than perhaps we realise on the outside looking in. Just one thing I wanted to ask you about, David, before we wrap up, is just given the... magnitude of Sunday, not necessarily in terms of the Champions League places, but in terms of the relegation battle, it's going to be an unbelievable final day. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on what those dressing rooms, those three dressing rooms in particular, are going to be like for Watford, for Villa and for Bournemouth going into the final day of the season, knowing that your Premier League survival is on the line. Is it nervousness? Is it a worry about your livelihoods? Or how do those dressing rooms tend to operate on a week like this?
Oh, it's tough. It's hard. I had a similar situation with Hull in 2012 where we were playing the last game to get promoted and we were playing Cardiff, who were champions. If you look back, that's a famous day in championship history because I don't know if you know, all the games kick off, but I think it was when the Watford were third, we were second, and there was only a point between us. Watford were playing Leeds, we were playing Cardiff, who were already champions. Watford goalkeeper got injured in the warm-up, so I believe they had to get a young kid from the stand who had been released during the week to go on the bench. Then the game kicked off or whatever. Almunia was in goal for Watford. He got injured after about 15 minutes, so they had to bring the kid on, who ended up making two mistakes for the goal. So like tensions are always running high. And if you look at the Premier League, I think going through the change rooms, I think Watford, I don't know the inside story in Nigel Pearson and what actually happened to why he was sacked. You know, he took over at Christmas and he'd done a fantastic job. Then he gets sacked. I know they played Man City, which is a very, very difficult game. Like, now they're going into their final game against Arsenal. You're thinking, their manager's been sacked. They've just taken a heavy defeat. Do you know what I mean? They'll be feeling the pressure a lot more than, say, an Aston Villa, who had a huge result against Arsenal. Like, they'll be feeling, you know, they're going to West Ham, that they can get a result. West Ham, I think we're done now. So Aston Villa will be in... spirits should be high and knowing it's in our hands. And then, like, Bournemouth just... like, nothing can seem to go right for Bournemouth. It's almost as if they'll be pulling their hair out. You know, they're playing Everton away, so, like, that's another tough game. And you look around the changing rooms, I feared for Villa. I just felt that they couldn't really keep a clean sheet and they never looked like scoring. I know they beat Arsenal 1-0 or whatever, but you'd have to, on the basis of the last game week performances, you'd have to probably back Aston Villa to stay up, as well with their fixture playing West Ham, who might have just, you know, feel like we're done, like, let's just get this season over and we can focus on next season. The change rooms are going to be... look, boys are fighting for their careers, they're fighting for their livelihoods. There's so much involved that people don't see, that if a club is relegated, if a club is relegated, people lose their jobs. That's not like players, that's, you know, staff in the stadiums, people who work on the training grounds. There's so much around it. And then, of course, you know, players probably end up having 50% wage cuts, 40% wage cuts. So there's a lot at stake, and it is... it is a nervous time and there's a lot of pressure involved. So, you know, it's a case of who can put that aside for 90 minutes and actually put in a performance and get a result for their team.
What's the ecstasy like when you actually do survive? I suppose 2014, when you stayed up with Hull City, it wasn't a final day of the season sort of job. I think you did it with a month to spare. But still, I'd imagine the elation is unbelievable.
Yeah, I think looking back on that season, we had played Fulham away. We were 2-0 down, came back and drew 2-2. Got a point. Shane Long scored late on, but like we'd felt at that moment, we're not at the magic 40 mark, but we're high enough that we're okay. We've got, I think it was, we had six games left, and we felt, you know, we'll get a result along the way, whether it be another draw or maybe get a win. But we actually went and lost six in a row. We lost our final games. It was only because of the FA Cup run that there was kind of like, we still had the buzz. If we hadn't have gotten that result against Fulham, it might have been totally different. But when you stay up, it's just knowing that I can go and I can enjoy my summer. I can go and I can relax. A lot of our lads would have gone playing internationals, but you go on a different form. You go, you know, it's always interesting. I always look at this when you go and you meet up for the international summer games after, whether it be a major tournament or friendlies or competitive fixtures, that, like, you have to get a feel that I could have been at the time relegated with Hull. You look at the Sheffield United boys, could have been promoted. You could have had you know, different lads who are at a different team have just stayed up, that there was such a mixed feeling of obviously when you went into those games. You know, there was times like we've obviously seen a lot of Irish lads being promoted over the last few years. So it's always interesting, like, and the joy that when you stay up is incredible, because you know then once the fixture list comes, you're looking for your Liverpools, your Man United, your Man Cities, when are you playing them, rather than, I've said this before, it's no disrespect to the Championship, but you don't get that excited looking at when you're playing whoever in the Championship. I won't mention teams in case anyone takes disrespect, like, but you know, there's a different buzz, do you know what I mean? And then you're looking, like, you look at Chelsea, they've signed Werner, Zajic, it looks like they're about to sign Havertz. You know, then you're like, oh, I can't wait to, you know, test myself against these fellas. The club are spending 40, 50, 60 million on a player. Like, you know, there's just a larger buzz in the Premier League.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, David, enjoy the final day of the season. Adrian, you got one more there, I think.
Just very quickly, David, and you're going to think I'm Alan Pardew, crazy, or I'm not. What did your dad say to you afterwards?
Let me just, all he said was, well done, because I didn't throw myself to the floor. And then he said, and then he just went, no press.
Right.
He said, no press.
Stay away from it. Is the corn coming out in him?
Yeah. He said, stay away from Owen, Nathan and all them. That's what he was saying. He just said, no, because at that age, obviously I said 6 years ago, I'd have been 25. You know what I mean? You're young. You're like, obviously it's a huge incident in the Premier League history. And then somebody's going to go, oh, David, how was the game? And then you thought, well, let's just get on to this. And I'd have had five, six, seven, eight questions like about the incident. So he just said, no press. And then he hammered me for our performance and my performance in the game.
Which was business as usual then.
Yeah, business as usual. Yeah.
Listen, David, it's been great chatting to you again this morning. Enjoy the final day of the season. We'll chat to you again soon.
See you later, guys.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.